brother. Oh, what's up?
This is a good big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop. Right on.
All right, welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. You know, I am probably at a point in my life right now where I am having a very difficult go of it as I'm watching now. And I don't know, maybe you may feel the same way, but as I'm watching our nation teetering on the difference between right and wrong. And you know, maybe we've seen it before. Maybe it's happened before. Maybe it's because, you know, I'm a bit more mature than I was before. But I think we're at a point in our nation's history that historians will be talking about for decades and decades to come, about where we are right now in our nation's history, and I am alarmed. And so, you know, it is with that backdrop, you know, I'm always happy to have my good friend Sandy Williams on because, you know, he consoles me sometimes and makes me understand that, you know, it's not the total end of the world. The bomb hasn't dropped yet. But I'll tell you, I'm just disgusted because everything that I see coming from our government right now makes me believe that all the things that people fought, bled, and died for in this nation are at stake. They're, you know, in jeopardy. And I almost feel like there's nothing we can do. And so having said that, I want to welcome back none other than my good friend Sandy Williams. And Sandy, I hope I'm not sounding melancholy. But go ahead.
Well, you might be sounding melancholy, and maybe you have cause. I think one of the things that's going on right now is that this government and this president are particularly transparent, and not necessarily in a sense that makes that a positive term, but what's happening now is, I think, what has gone on in our country in the past, which has been sort of the quiet part, the part we don't talk about, the part we don't ballyhoo, the part that the president doesn't get up and expend a lot of energy to extol, went on secretly. And even to the point where the president and the officers of the government would make sure that they could have plausible deniability. So in the past, the United States has participated in some things that we probably aren't very proud of looking backwards in times. We were very instrumental in having the Iranian people have an insurrection that threw Mogadish out of office in 1953 after he was the first democratically elected Mideastern leader ever in history, and threw Iran into the hands of the Shah of Iran, who was a regime puppet of the United States and a client of the United States, which has led to our current situation with Iran. We threw out Salvador Allende in Chile and had him replaced with a fellow named Pinochet. Pinochet was a dictator of a horrible sort. He probably matched Maduro almost in terms of the things that he was doing to the Chilean people with our support. But none of those things were things that the president of the United States stood up and claimed to have done. And they were all things that the United States and the people of the United States could kind of ignore because it was done secretly. But now, today, we find ourselves doing these same kind of and even more direct kinds of adventures in dabbling in the government of South America and around the world. but we're claiming it and we're actually aspiring to it. And we are doing such things as telling the world that we're going to take over the oil production of Venezuela, that the Venezuelan government is going to do as we tell them. The stooges are not secret stooges, people who we install and expect to respond to us quietly and privately. We're doing this publicly. And so the American people now have an opportunity to have a reaction to this kind of overt imperialistic activity. And I'm just not sure whether the American public has an appetite for this or not, because we've never had a situation where our government has behaved in quite the manner that it's behaving now.
You know, Sandy, we can, you mentioned international calamities that are taking place now, but then you add on to that what's happening inside of the borders, where the mother was basically assassinated. I mean, by government forces. I mean, and you're seeing this, and the American people, they don't have a stomach for that, Sandy, because they know there's no justification. And even though you see it with your own eyes, then political leaders come before the American people with a snobbish response to the killing of an American citizen like that. Well, she asked for it, and you know, it was a threat to all these people that we see with all these automatic weapons, Sandy, and there's an army of them and one lone little American woman, and somehow we're supposed to say their lives were threatened, Sandy. These are the kind of things I think that the American people are really just having a hard time, you know, dealing with.
Well, we're going to find out. I mean, that's the thing. We assume that the American people are a projection of how we're feeling, but they might or might not be. I suspect that what's going to happen is that there will be quite a very divided reaction. Some people will be positive about this, and other people will be very negative, and there won't be a lot of people who simply have neutral views of what's going on both domestically and internationally. Now, the kind of things we're doing internationally are the kind of things that frequently political leaders will choose to do to distract the public from whatever it is that's going on domestically or not going on domestically. And so, you know, we do find ourselves now spending lots of energy, lots of the media energy is being devoted to these questions of international affairs, what's going on in Venezuela. And we're not talking about affordability. We're not talking about healthcare. We're not talking about domestic issues, the things that actually really do matter to Tom, Dick, and Mary.
You know, Sandy, you know, I can't argue with you about whether or not the majority of our nation sees this the way I see it, or maybe the way you see it. It clearly is a divide, because we saw that during the election, right? There's a segment of the population that still thinks that they like the way things are going in this country, regardless of what the other half of us think. And so you might be right that we've got half of our countrymen who think that these kinds of things, we're Americans, we're better than the rest of the world, we should be able to take whatever it is we want. And I just don't think that bodes well for what our nation shows supposedly the rest of the world, that this is who we are. We've led people to believe that we're somebody different than that as a nation.
I wasn't suggesting that I thought that half the people, I don't know what the
number
is. Well,
not half, right, whatever.
Now, my question is, what will the polls show and how will the American people react? Because, you know, we've basically adopted an international policy based on this 2025 document that was issued by the current administration about its hegemonic view of the world, that there was Asian area, sphere of influence, there was the Western Hemisphere sphere of influence, and there was the European sphere of influence, and we were going to focus ourselves on the Western Hemisphere sphere of influence and interpret the Monroe Doctrine to mean that we could do as we choose in the Western Hemisphere and operate in a direct sort of imperialistic manner, dictating policy, as our Secretary of State said, that the policies we're going to dictate to Venezuela in the first instance will be policies that will be good for the United States, and then as a corollary to that, and also good for the Venezuelan people. Well, you know, that's an American first policy for Venezuela instead of a Venezuela first policy for Venezuela.
You know, Sandy, you know, I just am a little downtrodden because, you know, it's bad enough to have and hear what our president has to say, but he certainly got some characters around him in positions of power, the vice president, the secretary of state, the Secretary of War, who really, Sandy, appear to be heartless, and so they're running things, Sandy, and here we are, those of us who, you know, have a modicum of respect for what our nation has been or is or what it professes to be. And then these hardliners stand before us, Sandy, and the rest of what we people thought we were be damned, we're in charge. This is what is going to be.
Well, for instance, the president's statement about whether international law applied to the conduct of the United States, and I think his reaction and answer to that was, well, no, the only constraint on what I as president of the United States can do internationally is my own morality, whatever that morality is in my head, not a matter of laws or international law. And interestingly, that was sort of the way the world ran in the 1800s. That was, you know, might made right. And in the colonial world, there was no such thing as the ability of a small country to do as it wished. Small countries were all viewed as vassals to some large imperial center. So, you know, between the English and the Russians and the others who had large empires in the 1800s, small countries were all essentially subservient to one or the other. And this hegemonic view of the world that has been sketched out in this document that was issued recently has the same view, that there will be spheres of influence and that smaller countries within a sphere of influence of a major power would be expected essentially to be vassal states. So that would be totally coincident with, for instance, Vladimir Putin's view of Ukraine. Ukraine falls within the sphere of influence of the Russian Federation, having been an old part of the Soviet Union, and that it therefore should be a vassal state of Russia. And the idea that Ukraine would have NATO bases in it and would be more or less a vassal state to the West was an anathema to them and would be anathema to the policies set out in this 2025 document.
So, Sandy, that wouldn't be an issue if we hadn't condemned other nations for that exact same way of looking at the world. I mean, throughout my entire life, we've condemned nations for acting in this manner, Sandy.
Well, we've probably done it hypocritically because we have, in a way, behaved that same way when we chose to. Usually we've done it in the dark of night so that the activities in with respect to Muammar Gaddafi and the bombings that we took place in Libya, the bombings that took place in Yugoslavia, the efforts we made in Guatemala and Honduras
Yes.
and Panama
Yeah,
and Chile,
we destabilized
and
that
you
whole
know,
region.
it's a long list.
Right.
So you know, I think our conduct today is more reckless, I would say, in terms of exercising this power, and it is done more publicly, and we have stated our policy publicly. That we are as Stephen Miller said, we are a superpower and we are going to behave like a superpower, and that in the world of international affairs, the only thing that matters is power. And so might makes right.
You know,
And
Sandy,
that's essentially the same thing that was repeated by the president.
I saw a Republican senator. I can't remember his name, a long standing, well respected Republican senator who said and challenged the people who are making these statements on behalf of our government. He said it's amateur hour. Did you see the guy? He said this is amateur hour. Okay, you
Well,
can't do these things.
I think it's amateur hour to the extent that it reflects a bunch of people who've lost memory of why it is we've been in this world of where the rule of law is applied. Because ever since World War II, basic world peace has been sustained because countries have honored the rule of law. And only with an exception here and there has it been violated directly. We are now essentially repudiating the rule of law with respect to international affairs and saying that we can exercise our power however it is justified by the interest of the United States. And so we can flex our muscle toward Greenland because it's strategic, we say. And we're now going to try and sit down and negotiate with Denmark over Greenland with the threat, you know, by essentially putting our revolver on the table while we negotiate. You know, that's really, in fact, the representatives of the country said that, yeah, that's what we've been doing. We've been trying to gain leverage in our negotiation with Denmark by talking about the potential for military moves.
So Sandy, at the end of a lot of this, you correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm looking at it through the wrong prism, but all of it appears to be America thumbing her nose at China and at Russia and at saying, we're the superpower. Hey, don't forget, we're the guys who carry the big stick and you'll yield to us because we're the great United States of America. Every
Well,
move that they're making is kind of like that.
some would say that. Others would say that what we're doing is winking at both of them and saying, look, we're going to do as we wish in the Western Hemisphere, and we're going to nudge, nudge, wink, wink, allow you to behave more or less as you wish in your sphere of influence, China, and in your sphere of influence, Russia, because yes, we have great military might, but we have no interest in having an apocalyptic war with either one of you. And when great powers fight in today's world, it's an apocalypse. And so we're basically saying, let's avoid apocalyptic wars by simply cordoning the world off into three broad categories, and we'll stay out of your sandbox and you'll stay out of ours.
You know, Sandy, the only problem with that is you take the oil in Venezuela and you say, we're going to control that, okay? And it would be different, I would think, Sandy, if Russia and China didn't depend on some of that oil. But now we've cordoned that off and said, you can't have any of that.
Well, you've put your finger on the very issue that many people looking at the current situation and this idea of a world that's divided into three hegemonies and thinking that that could result in world peace. And many people look at that and say, no, whenever you have three giant powers like that, they begin to abrade on one another in various ways. And in today's world, where we're so interconnected to each other economically, for instance, having the United States in a position to potentially dictate the world price of oil could be a very significant problem for both Russia and China. And there are other ways that we could actually get under each other's skin, even though we're staying out of each other's sandbox. We're much more likely to have, in the long run, that apocalyptic confrontation than we otherwise would.
So, Sandy, let me, maybe these dire consequences that I see in my mind, maybe I'm, in talking to you, you make me think that, listen, this is, you know, things could change after the midterms. And if Donald Trump and the Republicans lose the midterms, maybe all of these dire consequences that we're talking about, Sandy, maybe they'll go away. Is it possible?
I'm afraid it isn't, because the one area that the president does have a great deal of unilateral power in is foreign affairs. And we're going to find out. The Supreme Court in the next 6 months are going to render rulings with respect to tariffs. I expect that the Supreme Court will find a way to sanctify what's happened, but to also indicate that there are limits on the power of the president to continue using tariffs in the same manner that he is today, declaring emergencies where they don't exist to allow him to impose tariffs totally at his own will. And that will have an impact on his capacity to do what he's doing. But it's not clear to me that Congress, even with a Democratic Congress, is going to be able to get in the way of the executive power with respect to international affairs, other than the deployment of troops internationally. And we already saw Congress stood up in a meek sort of a way to try and restrain the president's power with respect to commitment of troops to Venezuela. And I did note that this morning the president suggested that he wasn't going to do this second wave because it wasn't necessary anymore, so he didn't plan on deploying troops to Venezuela. I guess it was a way of saying, you didn't need to do that, Congress, because I wasn't going to do it anyway.
You know, Sandy, you said 6 months it might take for the Supreme Court to act on whether or not the president has authority for these tariffs. Sandy, 6 months is a long time. The damage that could be rendered.
By not issuing a mandamus or injunction against the imposition of the tariffs, the court allowed the tariffs to go into effect, the revenue to be collected, the effect of the tariffs to be experienced in world affairs. And so, you know, the status quo has changed dramatically since the time that the tariffs didn't exist, and the court hasn't had any rush to do it. I said it might take up to 6 months because typically the court renders all of its decisions from its term and is completing those decisions by the end of May, early June. So we can expect decisions no later than that time.
You know, Sandy, you look at our nation, and to me what it shows, and again, this is only from the perspective of one of its citizens, and certainly not from as learned a perspective that you and others see it. It'll be hard for me to see the nation another way after this. And I guess what I'm saying is, Sandy, I don't see how we go back. these doors have been opened. The chains have been kind of taken off. And now, you know, we've got at least two and three more years of this wrangling. Go ahead.
I think our nation has definitely lost its innocence. And maybe that's the way historians will record this down the road, as this being the time period where the wraps were taken off of an innocent view of the United States, and we've showed ourselves to be as we are. We've allowed or reallowed sort of tribalism to reappear within the country sociologically. We have people like the vice president saying, gee, he no longer has to apologize for being a white man. We've got our international affairs where we're declaring basically that we are the most powerful country in the world, might makes right, and look out the world in 2026. This is the United States decade. And so, you know, I think that all of this has essentially torn the veneer of innocence away from the way we try to appear to others and the way we visualized ourselves as a nation.
You know, Sandy, the racial aspect of it, yes, as a black man in this country, I see it, and it's horrific, and the things that are being done are out in the open, and so the wounds that they were attempting to heal. Now we've got a group of people who don't care, don't give a rip about those wounds, about the past and what took place. But Sandy, I would also say to you that Europe, where you've traveled, the Europeans certainly can't be looking at us through the same prism, Sandy, and they probably never will again. Can we fix that?
Well, no. I mean, reputations take a long time to build, and they only take a little while to fritter away. And so, you know, we'd have to rebuild our reputation as a trustworthy ally, and as a nation that is interested in the world rule of law, and is interested in honoring the sovereignty of other nations, and viewing them as entitled to be in existence and independent from overriding influence from third parties. So, you know, because Europe is filled with small countries.
Right.
Those are all countries that most of them, which are not interested in having a rule of law that says might makes right, because that's how they fell into the warfare of World War One. You know, when Germany, the largest country in Europe at the time, decided to flex its muscles. And so I think that we've lost our image. And I think it's just as important that we've lost our self-image. The neocons, which was the label given to the Paul Wolfowitz and others, right, during the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, who had a view that the United States was now the sole superpower. This was before the rise of China, or the obvious rise of China. There had been the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the United States was the only superpower left standing.
Right.
The neocons said, we're going to use this superpower to basically build democracy around the world. And so it was labeled nation building. But the nexus of it, at least the one that was talked about, we didn't talk about using that power to seize natural resources, although we tended to flex our muscle when natural resources were involved, so in Libya or in Iraq or in some of those circumstances. But at least we gave lip service to what we were trying to do, was to install democracy. This current action in Venezuela could have been colored that way, except the initial reaction of our government was, no, we're gonna do business with the existing group of leaders who we said was illegitimate. They stole the election from the winners. a group of people who were known to be terribly corrupt and terribly destructive societally within Venezuela. But we decided to stick with the vice president because we said we had enough leverage over her to make her do what we wanted her to do. And if that doesn't include getting rid of the secret police in Venezuela and getting rid of the horrible civil rights violations that the regime has carried out, and if it doesn't ultimately include having an election, which in the last election was apparently won by Messrs. Rodriguez and Machado, and Ms. Machado, then we've just dropped all of the element of neocon that was meant to be nation building in the name of democracy. And so I fear that what we're currently seeing is the implementation of a foreign policy which is premised on just having stooges in place who will do our bidding, and it doesn't matter whether they are the result of a democratic process.
So Sandy, you brought up the neocons, and it's a perfect, part of this conversation, because I remember the neocons well. The difference with the neocons, though, Sandy, were they weren't disrespectful of the American people. They didn't rub the American people's nose in it and make the American people feel as if they have no part in this government. I think that's what makes this time more dangerous than the time with the neocons.
Well, the neocon movement has continued. I mean, the fact is that the current administration ran fundamentally, and J.D. Vance in particular very specifically, ran directly against the neocons, using the term neocon and describing them as wanting the United States to dabble in regime change and nation building around the world, which was very expensive and very unsuccessful. And so I suppose the defense they're now going to raise to what they're doing in Venezuela is, hey, we aren't involved in regime change. We're just involved in training the regimes to be responsive to the American interest and to be American first in terms of the kind of policies they adopt. And so here we are taking all of the oil production out of Venezuela. I don't know under what international law that's being done. I guess it's being done under the law of might makes right. But we're basically saying that we're going to be in control of all of the revenue that's earned by the government of Venezuela, and we're going to use that leverage to make sure that the regime in Venezuela does what we want them to do.
So Sandy, here, and I heard them, the president say, and even Marco Rubio, we're going to be there for at least and running it for at least a year, more than a year.
That's what we said in Afghanistan, incidentally.
Yeah, well, and we were there 20 years. But, yes. but let me ask you, Sandy, in the face of all of these things that they're talking about right now, and what are the American people supposed to do? Are we chopped liver? So our needs that are going to grow even more in this period are going to be just dismissed. And so those of us who continue to, they're not going to snap their fingers and the food prices are going to change. They're not going to snap their fingers and the housing is going to be fixed. None of these things are going to happen without hard work. But if our focus is more towards, they've forced us now to look at a global dynamic more so than our own, what's in the best interest of our own day-to-day needs. What are we forced to choose? Are we supposed to say, well, we're not worried about what's going on globally, even though these things that they're doing globally are mighty impactful, Sandy? We can't totally, as American citizens, ignore those things. They're going to have some major impact on our lives in the near and the future.
Well, you said a mouthful because obviously there's lots of domestic things that need attention paid to them. I mean, the president keeps doing things. I think he opens a drawer and tries to figure out what it is he might be able to do. This executive order he's issuing to make it unlawful for large investors to own single-family homes could have an impact on the housing market. I mean, it could cause them to have to sell back into the marketplace a substantial volume of homes that they've bought. But the problem goes far deeper than that. The problem we have with housing is a serious shortage of housing, and we also have a serious affordability issue. The cost of building housing is results in a square footage cost for rentals, which many families can't afford because they don't earn enough.
Right.
And so, we've got a whole lot of work to do in our economy. And tariffs, which is the medicine, the only medicine that's being applied by the current administration, are really very unlikely to solve the problem. And if we get a tariff dividend sent to us, it's going to be a bit like let them eat cake, send them something to make them happy around election time. But the fact of the matter is that by isolating our country in the manner that we're talking about doing, by creating essentially a pariah state for us in which everyone cowers before us unhappily, in the long term, all that unhappiness gets converted into team behavior, in which the world teams up against us.
Yes.
And some of the ways they can team up against us will be the US dollar as a reserve currency, which requires everyone to both trust it and to be willing to participate in a system which has the US dollar as the reserve currency. And if we keep up on the current course of international conduct, I think we can expect many more parts of the world to decide that maybe they don't want to transact their business in dollars.
You know, Sandy, you just talked about the rest of the world teaming up. We're certainly, almost forcing the rest of the world in this, America first, rhetoric that we're hearing. It's not rhetoric, it's beyond rhetoric. America first. And the rest of the world is all watching. I mean, even our allies, Europe is saying, okay, they forced us to spend more money on our own defense. Part of the reason why we and NATO and all these things, we realize that, America being carrying the biggest stick. And so we were kind of beholding NATO to America, and everything was fine the way it was working. As you talked about the trades between us and all those things are collapsing, Sandy, so quickly. Yeah, it made sense, I guess, from when the president was saying they've got to spend more money on defense. But I think by them doing that, Sandy, they're starting to realize, hey, we don't have to bow down and be a little brother to America. There are more, all those different European nations combined kind of have a little more power, and if they kind of work together and they don't have the same issues of blood that with China that America has, right? And so they can look at China as opposed to America. China's going to be more willing to trade with them and work with them than they can with our own nation.
Well, yeah, everyone's going to be forced to think about options to dealing with the United States, including NATO. I mean, right now, NATO's hugely dependent on the American munition industry to arm itself. But Germany, Sweden, France, all of them have the capacity to build airplanes, jet fighters, and to create their own capacity to arm themselves. And a lot of the American power to date, back in the days of the Cold War, we used to talk about client states. And the client state status was really derived from the fact that that countries around the world had to decide whether they were going to use Soviet armaments or U.S. armaments. And if they used U.S. armaments, you could be quite confident they'd never go to war with the United States, because they were dependent on the United States for parts and the capacity to arm themselves. And that has continued to be the case. You notice us actively trying to sell our armaments to Turkey and make
Right.
sure that they don't use Russian-built things. We're selling armaments to Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. And that's much the reason why we do it. And so, what we're doing is we're playing with a bunch of fragile coincidences that have occurred since World War II that has put the United States into a very profoundly powerful position, but a position where the power is waning. Because in 1991, when the neocons began their thought process, when the Soviet Union had collapsed and Russia was on its knees, when China had not yet appeared on the scene as an international power, the United States was in a unique position. We're not in that position anymore.
You know, Sandy, you kind of put it in a package that, it's just kind of hard to swallow, because I don't see a lot of positives in this trajectory of where our nation is headed right now. And because it's like the world is closing in on us. And so even inside of it, inside of the nation, all of these other things just keep happening. And Sandy, I think there'll be more and more stress on the American people. I just read where, and I'm not saying it's not the right thing to do, but people who owe student loans, who certainly owe it. Nobody's arguing about whether or not they owe student loans or not, Sandy, but they're already struggling, many American people. And now you add this, we'll be garnishing their wages for student loans. And Sandy, wouldn't we be better off if we figured out a way maybe to allow them? Here's another little tidbit. May appear to be a tidbit, but it's more than that to people who owe, to allow them to refinance those loans where they're not as high as they are. Just doing something to help the American people at a time, Sandy, when they're in such a distress.
Well, the American people are a couple of different baskets, right? We've got the top 25% of the American people who are thriving, who can't even seem to empathize with the other 75% of the people who are at various levels of struggle in their day-to-day existence and their day-to-day financial existence. So, I think almost every publication and every poll indicates that at least 60% of the families in the United States are living paycheck to paycheck, not saving money, not in a position to undertake additional costs or additional debts. And so those people have a different experience than the 40% who aren't in that position. And I fear that, again, this is all kind of an issue of the degree to which empathy is being applied in the political process. And I think as our international affairs are deciding that we aren't going to be empathetic with respect to the rest of the world. And I think internally our domestic policies are increasingly reflecting the notion that we're not going to be empathetic with one another.
So, Sandy, has empathy historically been a part of the political concept? Are they, do they mesh at all?
Well, in a country in which a great deal of the movement of the conservative side is premised on it being a Christian nation, and when if one of the pillars I think of the Christian liturgy is empathy,
Right.
and so you would think that as a nation imbued with that culture, empathy would be something we wouldn't even need to talk about, that it would be built into the way we went about things. But it doesn't seem to be, and it seems to be that we're essentially trying to eliminate empathy from the processes, and it's going to be much more a question of each man for himself, each person for themselves, and to the extent that you aren't thriving, it's your fault.
So, Sandy, do you know what, and I'm sure you do know, when self-preservation becomes the order of the day, chaos and anarchy will happen inside of this nation. They can act as though it's not going to be the case, Sandy, but it's human nature that if you are being completely shut out in a society of plenty, and there's a handful of people who are thriving, you know, and your children are hungry, Sandy, you know, you're not going to sit back. I mean, this is, Sandy, we've seen this happen to other nations, right? I mean, this is not new.
Well, I think when people are cornered and they are desperate, if you can't pay your bills, if you can't feed your family, if you can't affect public policy that's upsetting to you, for instance, the ICE agent process that's going on throughout the country, people who are frustrated by it are forced to go to the streets. What are the options? Particularly in a world in which things are being implemented by executive order, the only place they could picket that would make sense would be the White House, right? They could go to Washington and picket the White House. It doesn't help that much to go picket the office of your state your federal House of Representatives member, or the U.S. Senate member, because they aren't doing the things that are affecting your life. It's being done by the president. And so it leaves you in a much more desperate kind of a role. Yeah, I think you've earlier said you felt helpless. I think lots of people in the current circumstances are feeling the helplessness of what it is like to live in a situation that is much more authoritarian than it is democratic. And then the question is, how do they feel about it? There are some people who are probably happy by the fact that now things are happening. We're not in a quagmire of process. We're in a quagmire maybe that's being created by a lack of process.
You know, Sandy, I have to tell you, I was talking with some students yesterday at one of the schools in Milwaukee, and I had a conversation with them about, you know, why in many instances some from my generation are afraid of these young men, and they candidly told me that they don't do the things that they're doing because that they're, you know, just lawless and they're just guys who want to hurt people. They told me this in no uncertain terms, Sandy. They said, well, you know, we don't have any money. We don't have any jobs. It's, you know, we don't have, our families are struggling and suffering. We sell drugs because we want to help our mothers. We want to help our sisters and brothers. We don't do these things because we're terrible people. And Sandy, when they said that to me, these are young boys in 9th, 10th, and 11th grade. And you know, Sandy, I didn't have an answer for them other than just hang in there and things will change. Well, Sandy, it's easy for me to tell them hang in there and things will change. But I'm not living in their reality. And what I would say to that 40% of the American people who are living well, Sandy, they don't live in the reality of the other 60% of the American people. They don't understand.
There you go with that empathy thing. I mean, unless we can build a bridge that's based on people trying to project the situations of others, I think we're going to end up with this complete individualism, and we can look at ourselves and congratulate ourselves for how well we've done with our hard work, and suggest that anyone who isn't doing as well simply hasn't committed themselves to the process. And that is at the core of a lot of what American individualism is built on. It's at the core of some people's concept of the marketplace. But the fact is that some people are born into a situation where the result of industry and effort isn't necessarily rewarded.
So Sandy, and I don't I didn't want to say that to point at the conditions that these young guys are dealing with, these young people in urban centers are dealing with. I said that because this 60% of the American people, many who have done all the right things, Sandy, who have been able to at least at some point in time take advantage of a nation that offered sustenance to the American people. That sustenance has been taken away, Sandy.
Well, maybe, we're getting near the end of this thing, and maybe to put a knot on it that ties it all together, I do think that empathy, which is frequently manifested by the rule of law, laws are usually set up to protect ourselves from one another and to make sure that we are respectful to one another. And what seems to be happening currently in the socio-political environment we're living in is that we've decided to drop empathy, we've de-emphasized the rule of law, and we've put in its place something much more like the rule of nature, which is to the powerful go the spoils, to the victor goes the spoils.
So, Sandy,
And
empathy.
so to the victor goes the spoils in our economy, to the victor go the spoils internationally. I think our president even used that term when he described the fact that we didn't take the oil from Iraq to finance our very expensive adventure in Iraq, and that he was going to make sure that we did take the oil from, for instance, Venezuela.
So, Sandy, empathy is a moral emotion. It's not. It's not something that you should have to think about. It is something that's a human kind of thing that you feel towards your fellow human beings. It's not something that's intellectual.
Well, I'm not sure of that. I think it does take. I mean, empathy is something that we desire to have, but it takes a process to try and understand the situation of others and to be open to it. And I'm just simply suggesting that a consistent thread for our conversation is that I think from a socio-economic and political standpoint, our current societal situation is de-emphasizing the rule of law, de-emphasizing empathy as it might be employed either instinctively by individuals or through the exercise of the rule of law, and that we're minimizing the level of empathy that we're deploying both domestically and internationally.
So, Sandy, the last thing. So, the rule of law transposes and supersedes all these other things. The rule of law is at the root of a society. Well, we're watching the rule of law being cast out the door. The rule of law doesn't have any, almost as if it has no relevance at the highest level of our nation now. Of those political leaders in our nation, if you take that away, what do we have?
Well, the rule of law is what separates us from the uncivilized. It's what separates us from anarchy. It's what separates us from the instability of living in a situation where the conduct between us is unpredictable and is premised on power. It's a playground without teachers. You know, it's a place where might makes right, or whatever other rules might apply. And so, you know, I think that what we need to, as an American people, focus on is the extent to which it's important that we all give credence to the legal fabric in which we're living, and then we make sure that that legal fabric is properly deployed. And we don't have, for instance, a constitution that might just simply be ignored.
You know, Sandy, last thing, I agree with you that we certainly, that law has to be the guiding factor on what happens in a civilization. And we as citizens can feel that way, but if those above us don't feel that way, Sandy, we're cooked.
Yeah. I just think that what we need to get back to, and what the norm that we have lived in this society for quite a long time, has been that we honor the rule of law without necessarily testing it regularly in court, without thumbing our nose at it and saying, yeah, go ahead and enforce it. Let's see if you can. And so now, if we're going to throw out the notion that we need to abide by norms, and if one of those norms is to follow the rule of law obediently and affirmatively, then I think we're slipping into a very bad place.
Hey, Sandy, as always, just a great conversation with you, and I always learn so much from our conversations. I'm honored and privileged to have you as a friend and a colleague, and to be able to discuss these serious conversations that keep cropping up, Sandy. I listen to, you know, all these people from all over the country having these conversations and dialogues, but I don't think they're broaching it in the manner that you and I are, because we take some time with each one of these. We don't talk about it 5 minutes and then jump to the next subject. It requires, you know, more than 5 or 10 minutes on these issues.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this stuff. You know, it weighs on our minds, I think, and I think it's helpful to have a dialogue to talk about them.
All right, my friend, have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too.
All right, see you next time.